Debsy, I mean, we'll just talk through a couple of the technology stories that have been in the news the last couple of days anyway. I'm a little bit worried about this one. Google funding an automated news project. Is this going to mean the end of my job?
The end of journalism as we know it. Well, you know, the thing about artificial intelligence is that people don't quite get the breadth of jobs that will eventually be replaced by it. You know, it's not just sort of factories and things like that. You're talking about solicitors, you're talking about accountants, some would say that's no bad thing, and to an extent, yes, I'm afraid journalists as well. I mean, this is not the end.
Good.
But it may be the beginning of the end.
Sigh of relief.
So Google is funding a robot journalism project from the Press Association, and this is about generating news pieces for local media, and local media finds it very difficult to produce economically produced stories because, you know, its circulation is often not large enough to employ enough journalists to do a good job. They do their best, but you know, it's under threat. So you could say, well, you know, if this isn't done, then a lot of the local media will shut down anyway. It depends how it's funded, of course. So this is a Press Association project, and Google has put in £622,000. And the idea is that there will still be human beings in the loop, as it were, but they'll be vital to the process at the moment. But it allows the Radar project, as it's called, to harness artificial intelligence to scale up the volume of stories that it will produce. So there'll still be human beings involved in it. But I think that's the pattern that we're seeing with the introduction of AI, artificial intelligence-based systems, is that, you know, they don't just jump in, you know, 2 feet first. One, because they can't yet do it, and two, because they don't want to scare the natives, as it were. But this is the trend, and the amount of human interaction involved in a lot of these will reduce over time. So yeah, I think it is the way it's going, and we will have to think about what our skill set is and how that will progress. I mean, being an AI engineer might be quite a good
I might
job.
Have to retrain.
I think we all do to an extent. I think, you know, and it's coming. You know, it's not this sci-fi thing that's in, you know, a long way in the future. It's been happening for you know, many years. But as I say, the categories of jobs that it will usurp will increase. I mean, you see what's happening now with automated vehicles. You know, I wouldn't want to be an Uber driver. I mean, wouldn't want to be one for a variety of reasons anyway, but you wouldn't want to be in a taxi driver, because you can see companies like Uber don't invest huge sums of money in, you know, robot vehicles without a game plan. And the game plan, of course, is that they're going to do away with one of their largest overheads.
Absolutely. And now another really interesting story. We see a lot with WhatsApp now. When you start a new conversation with somebody, it talks about end-to-end encryption, and reports that doctors and nurses are using WhatsApp and, slightly more worryingly, Snapchat to share information about patients across the NHS.
Yes. Yeah. So this is according to a GP who said that he's aware of a number of medical groups using WhatsApp to discuss patients. Of course, the use of internet-based messaging apps like WhatsApp and Snapchat is not allowed, and it shouldn't be the case. But it probably highlights the fact that the NHS is so very far behind in the systems that it does provide. People are turning to these systems, doctors and other professionals are turning to these systems because the NHS hasn't developed or bought in a safe and secure system for use within the NHS. And I think an interesting statistic is that the UK's largest purchaser of fax machines is the NHS.
Wow, they're still using them.
So yeah, and you know, actually there is, and you know, solicitors' offices use DX and also fax machines because there are still benefits to fax, funnily enough, and one of them is much harder to hack a fax than an email. So there are benefits to it, but it's appalling. And you know, the NHS has only just had its knuckles wrapped by the Information Commissioner's Office because it shared 1.6 million patient records with Google's DeepMind. So DeepMind was a British company, the AI company that got snapped up by Google, and this was a project where the NHS was meant to be sharing some data with Google's DeepMind project so that they could use artificial intelligence to spot which patients were at risk of kidney injury. So, and this is going to be a big deal, the use of artificial intelligence to help diagnose. IBM has got a program called Watson that also has been put towards diagnosis of cancer and treatment regimens for cancer being developed by computer. But the way in which the data was shared breached UK data rules, and as I say, they've been slapped on the wrist, and it really is a worry. I remember a few years ago when we were given the chance, Carissa, to decide whether we wanted our data stored, you know, on the NHS computer systems, and the benefit of it was always meant to be that, you know, any part of the NHS could access your medical records, and therefore, you know, God forbid that you were, you know, trolleyed into an A&E department and you weren't able to tell them that you were allergic to this or needed that, that the medical records would follow you wherever you went. And I know that a lot of people opted out of that because they just didn't trust that the NHS could keep their personal data secure, because there's very little data that relates to us that is more personal than our medical records.
Yeah, absolutely. People are very protective of those.
And unfortunately, we see almost on a weekly basis stories about how the NHS is failing to safeguard our data, and their computer systems are weak, and, you know, all the rest of it. And it's all a little bit too cozy with the likes of some of these AI companies as well, because these things can be done, but they have to be done in a way that protect you know, our privacy and our identities in particular. It can be done, but a lot of work needs to go into that, and it's not happening at the moment. So I think that's deeply worrying. I looked at that story and I thought, we're actually losing this battle for privacy, much as, you know, people like me yat on about it interminably. I actually think we're almost at that tipping point where, you know, we can't win.
Yeah.
Which is
worrying.
Yes.
Very worrying. Right, we'll crack on with some people's questions. So the numbers you need, 85058 on the text or 08085 909 693. We can speak to Graham, who's in Liverpool, who's on the phone. Good morning, Graham.
Morning, Carissa.
Morning. How can Febsy help you this morning?
First of all, hi, Febsy.
Hello.
Is it possible to have Carissa's voice instead of Siri on my phone?
You really wouldn't want that. Trust me, it gets so annoying.
Only if Carissa is willing to sit down and record every phoneme used in the English language.
No, just a wake-up call will do fine.
We'll see what we can do.
Well, Carissa, I think you might have found a new line of business for yourself there.
Great. I mean, we said we needed to retrain me. I can retrain to be the voice of people's operating systems. How can we really help?
Right. I've got an Alexa Dot, which you find okay. But everything you ask it, it comes up on your phone, doesn't
it? In the app, yeah.
Is there any way of deleting it? Or is it going to fill up my memory on my phone?
It won't fill up the memory in particular, because it you know, the each entry. So just to explain, just take a step back for those that don't know what we're talking about, Graham, which include me, of course. So the dot is the device within which this artificial intelligence entity called Alexa lives. Sorry for all those that I've just woken up by saying that word. it comes from Amazon, and you can ask it questions, and you can ask it to do certain things for you. So you can ask it about, you know, what's the weather like, or ask it to play music, or read you an ebook, or read you an audiobook. So it does a lot of different things, and week by week, Amazon are adding to the things that it can do. So it can now control your lighting and your heating and everything else just by speech. And we've heard on this program actually how some people actually just use it for company, which again is, you know, one can feel two ways about that, but it's definitely, again, the way things are going. So when you do that, there's the standard Alexa and the Echo and the Echo Dot, they don't have screens on them, although versions with screens are coming along. So it's a purely speech interface. Now, to sort of make up for that, you get a companion app that runs on your smartphone, which is the Alexa app. And everything that you say to it and how it responded is listed as a sort of a trail, as it were, on within the app on your smartphone. You can delete those individually or en masse, And indeed, you can delete what Amazon is holding about you on their servers as well. I wouldn't particularly worry in terms of it taking up too much space on your device, because it's compared to all the other things that your device is used for, that's not one of the more memory hungry activities. But if you've got, you are concerned about that, most people would delete it for privacy reasons, or because maybe someone else has got access to their app and they don't want to admit that they asked Alexa a particular question.
I swore at it, to be honest, Pepsi, because it just kept on saying I don't understand this sort of thing, so.
She's getting brighter and frankly she sings now and she can rap. Have you asked her to rap?
She's just learning.
It is like that. I mean, Alexa has also been a witness in a murder trial.
Really?
In the United States, an Amazon Echo machine was being used by a hot tub in the backyard of an American man who was murdered in his hot tub. And initially, Amazon didn't want to cooperate because they didn't want people to understand or draw attention to the fact that, you know, a lot of what you say in Alexa's presence is recorded and kept on their servers. It was thought by the police that Alexa may have heard some of the conversation leading up to the murder. So those records were subpoenaed and Alexa effectively testified. The other interesting thing, and one of the things that gave it away, was it was thought that the person involved in the murder used a large amount of water to wash away all the blood. And they were able to use a smart water meter that was attached to the house effectively to testify to say, yeah, this is when that huge amount of water was used. So they were able to put a time to the murder, that the cleanup occurred at a certain time, and therefore the murder just before that. So it is quite interesting that, you know, all these devices are capturing data about us. I think swearing at it, Graham, is probably the least the least that we have to worry about.
I think that's why I wanted Carissa to be me.
I'll swear back.
Well, I was going to say, when it starts swearing back, that's when you have to worry about it, unfortunately.
Can I ask you, if you download music, is it of MP3 quality, or is it condensed even lower than that sort of thing?
The music is streamed rather than downloaded, so just, you know, it's just a small difference, but the device doesn't have any accessible memory where you download it into it. You just stream music. And if you're an Amazon Prime customer, you get access, I think, to a couple of million songs.
I've been paying $3.99 a month. And if I asked for, say, Beyonce's Lemonade, it would only play 30 seconds off each track. Now, is that to get me to join Prime, where I get probably the whole album?
So the way it works is you get, by virtue of being a Prime customer, which, you know, started off as being just free next day delivery, and then ended up being all sorts of add-ons like e-book lending library, of course, Prime Video, being able to watch video and all that. Within that Prime membership, which I think was traditionally £79 a year, I think they're currently offering it for £59, and students can get it cheaper still, by the way. I think the Prime membership gives you access to a couple of million tracks, which is, you know, quite valuable. The total library is bigger than that. So if you're on Prime and you go for a song that's not within that 2 million, then it plays you a bit, and that's to entice you to spend more on an additional subscription for access to more music. I have to say that the stuff that's included in Prime is personally enough for me.
It'd take a while to listen to 2 million songs.
Well, it's just that 2 million is not enough. I think the figure's 2 million. Forgive me if it's wrong, but the number that comes within Prime as standard is not enough to mean that you can, you know, dump your own music collection. Anything that you could ever think about playing will be there. But the other one is, and there are various models for this. So you can pay a smaller amount per month and just have it work on one Echo box, just one Echo. Even if you own more than one, it'll only work on one. On the other hand, if you pay $7.99 if you're a Prime customer, or $9.99 if you're not a Prime customer, then you get access to the whole lot on any device. So it is the way things are going, you know. And I'm kind of reminded of Steve Jobs when he held aloft the first iPod and said, you know, you can store, you know, whatever it was, 100 music tracks or whatever on this device. And at that point, it was all about still owning the music and you know, carrying around your complete music collection on a portable device. But as internet access has become more and more ubiquitous, people are thinking, well, not really much point in curating your own collection. Better just to stream it. I actually say that that's not necessarily true. And the fact that more vinyl has been sold in the last year than CDs is also testament to the fact that there are people who still recognise that there is something visceral about being able to, you know, touch and hold an album or a gatefold sleeve or whatever, and you know, students are often to be found now, you know, in hi-fi shops buying turntables.
Yes, this is very true. All the hipsters have got turntables.
Yeah, absolutely. And have you seen how much they're charging for the albums? I'm so happy I've held on to my vinyl.
See, I got rid of, well, thank you for your question, by the way, Graham, but I got rid of all my CDs and only ever stream music now, but I can't get rid of my books. So
That's interesting, because I would happily rip or copy my CD collection and get rid of it, you know, just dump it or put it in storage or whatever. But I wouldn't do that to my vinyl collection ever. And that's partly because of the quality of, I don't mean the sound quality, but the quality and the smell and, you know, these sort of interactions that we have with the media. Because CDs, you know, CD is pretty much the last generation of physical media. We won't be buying physical media, you know, anymore. Yeah. We, as you say, we'll stream it and download it. And
I just got bored of dusting them.
I don't know. I always used to, it must be me, I used to enjoy putting an album on a turntable and just, you know, going from the middle to the outer edge with one of these little dust things and just seeing how much dust could come off it and whether it would sound better. And I'd love doing, now I'm really showing my age, but you could do like mixtapes and stuff, and you'd have to, on most turntables, you have to wind back one revolution to allow it to pick up speed, so that as it came round to one revolution, you could take your finger off the pause record button and just start the recording, and you could do, you know, very sharp editing without any high tech. And so
we digress.
The fun's gone. Oh, okay, I digress.
That's okay.
Shoot me. What can I do?
We'll do a few more questions. Joe has tweeted, and you know, we always say when we do this phone in, no question too simple. And so Joe wanted to know, how should I charge my mobile? Should I put it on a long overnight charge or top it up through the day? I've kind of resigned myself to the fact that I have to charge mine about four times a day now.
Yeah. Okay. So most modern smartphones are designed to be charged overnight, in that you will use pretty much all their power during the course of the day. So by the time you get to the end of the day, you need to charge it. So make use of that time overnight. Make sure that you've got a safe quality charger and a good cable that's not frayed. Make sure the phone is on a non-combustible surface, ideally, just in case, you know, the worst happens. You don't want, you know, a fire hazard from it. But generally speaking, they're designed to be charged overnight, because when they get to full charge, they don't or should not overheat. What they do is what's called trickle charging, where it goes to 100% and then it discharges a couple of percent and recharges, and it recharges and discharges that last couple of percent to stop the device from being damaged or overheating. So that's the way that they're designed to be used. That said, if it doesn't get you through the whole day, Joe, then by all means charge it during the day. And of course, as we see more and more wireless charging, you know, you're going to, the direction in which we're heading is devices will be automatically topped up throughout the day at a variety of locations, you know, and you'll even be able to have wireless power for things like television sets, so that you'll get to the point where you don't necessarily have to plug TV sets in, that devices will draw power from the ether, as it were.
Oh, that'll be neat. No cables down the back.
Yeah, I worry slightly about the health implications of having that much power. Yeah. Belting around unnecessarily, but you know, People don't like wires.
It'll be nice and tidy. Everyone will be lovely and tidy.
It'll be nice and tidy, yeah, indeed. So Joe, having given you the long answer, the short answer is charge it overnight. If you need to top it up during the day, do that as well. Lithium-ion batteries, which are used in these devices, don't exhibit what's called a memory effect, but which means, you know, by charging it in a particular way, you don't deplete the overall useful amount of charge that it can hold. It will die over, you know, a period of time, a couple of 300 charges, and it will start holding less power. But charge it overnight and top it up during the day if you need to.
Okay, we've got another caller. Martin in Doncaster is on the line. Good morning, Martin.
Morning, Clarissa.
Good morning. How can Fevzi help?
Well, I've just purchased an Acer tablet.
Yep.
I think it's a 110 or a 101. I'm not quite sure what number it is.
Mm-hmm.
But I can't get into it because it asked me for a password, and I don't know what password to put in. That's the matter, what password I put in.
Okay.
It still won't let me in. And it says confirm password, and I know I'm putting exactly the same one in. And it just comes up with the caption saying, passwords don't match, but I know for a fact that they do because, I mean, I'm putting the same one in and I've got it written down on a piece of paper as well, so I know it's the same one.
Okay. Is this, Martin, is this a brand new tablet?
Yeah, okay. It's a brand new one. Yeah,
so no one's entered a password there before you?
Well, I can't see that. I have no question.
Right. And the password that it's asking for, does that seem to you to be the password that locks the device, or could it be the password that's used to access Wi-Fi?
Then we could access Wi-Fi because it's just not letting me in at all.
So did you say
I'm into Wi-Fi because, I mean, I've got that and I've been into setup and Wi-Fi is there and working.
So hold on. Forgive me because I'm not quite clear now. Did you say it was the password that is used to access Wi-Fi, or it's the password that locks and unlocks the device as a whole?
It locks and unlocks the device as a whole.
I understand. All right. Well, if it's asking you to enter it for the first time, and it sounds like it is because it's asking you to repeat that, it can just be finger trouble. I mean, you do need to do it very carefully and make sure you know whether you've got your caps lock on or not, because that often causes issues. And some tablets also have the ability to show the password as you type it. A lot of them will only show you a series of little dots for security, but there's often a setting there that says show password. So you could try doing that. But if it's purely, you know, part of the setup, does it give you the opportunity to skip over it? Do you absolutely need to set up a password for this? Will it allow you in? You mentioned that you were getting as far as the Wi-Fi pages. So will it allow you past that point without entering a password?
Yeah, it must do because, I mean, it won't let me in at all now. At one time I got in and I got into settings and everything, but it won't let me in at all now.
Okay, well, if it won't let you in at all, then you're faced with doing a what's called a factory reset, which is usually a combination of buttons. It varies from make and model, but it could be, for example, a combination of the power button and the volume up or the volume down button or some such. So if you look up for that particular model, how to do either sometimes called a hard reset or a factory level reset, the downside of that is it will take it back to how it was when it was brand new. So any data you will have stored and any settings you will have entered will be lost and have to be...
So
if it's locked you out, it's probably because you've entered a password, it's accepted it, but it was slightly different to the one you thought you were entering. So, for example, the use of the caps lock key or an errant key press could cause that. So
that might be the problem then, yeah, with caps key, yeah. That might be the problem, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's very easily done. When it doesn't show you what you're typing for the sake of security, it's very, very easy. And I've had this problem. When I'm setting up email accounts, I have to type it very carefully. And sometimes I could swear blind I'd done it correctly. And then when I do it a little bit more carefully, it suddenly works. So if, however, it's locking you out, try it. You know, try it very carefully. If it's locking you out and you think, well, the error was when I entered the password the first time and it's not what I think it should be, then you're faced with resetting the machine in the way that I've described.
Good luck with that, Martin. Fingers crossed it'll work. I have variations on the same password and I can never remember which one it is. So I always end up just resetting it.
Can I tell you that this idea of varying the same password is very dangerous and only slightly...
Oh, no, don't tell me that.
Well, I'll tell you now, because it's only slightly better than using the same password everywhere, because you know when they have software programs that are designed to crack passwords?
Yeah.
They don't... I mean, you can do what's called brute forcing, where it just goes through every combination of, you know, letters, numbers, lowercase, uppercase, and special characters till it cracks it. But... What will often happen is, let's say a particular website that you use is hacked. So they have the password that you've got your email address that you maybe use on a number of different services online, maybe your online banking, maybe your online shopping, and it's got a particular password, and you think, oh well, I'm okay because I've used only that password in this one site. But then you've got a little rule where you modify it slightly, the password, you know, dependent on the site, and it's a derivation of the name of the site or something like that. I don't expect you to reply to that, but what I'm saying is that the software is now often smart enough to look for those sort of little tweaks that people do to their passwords, and often they'll take elements of the name of the website and try and combine it with the password or other variables.
I'm going to have to be a bit cleverer.
because AI is also being used to crack passwords now.
Oh, thanks AI.
So we're going to have to be intelligent, more so intelligent than the artificially intelligent beings.
But a successful novelist, a body at the bottom of the staircase.
Beyond Reasonable Doubt.
The new podcast phenomenon from BBC Five Live.
Download and subscribe now.
Fevzi, let's go through some of these questions. One that's been emailed in from Julian, which says, a few days ago, Yahoo Mail decided to stop paragraphing again, as it did about 6 to 8 months ago. I got it to work on Firefox, but not on MS Edge. Why has the paragraphing dropped out of Yahoo Mail again? It went down a couple of days ago. The screen said something like, error, it's being worked on. Previous to that, it was having problems saving drafts and accessing the inbox and sent items. Is this another Windows 10 upgrade problem?
No, I think the problem's more likely to be with Yahoo Mail themselves, so I would hold tight. It may be that it doesn't like some of the things that have changed on your machine, and that could include Windows 10, but ultimately I think it's incumbent upon Yahoo Mail to play well with, you know, common operating systems such as Windows 10. I wouldn't go... So a general rule of thumb with you know, email problems is this: don't start changing all your settings to try and get something to work when it's just stopped working recently, because more often than not, the problem is on the server side, on their side, not yours. And if you go changing things, you know, people start hacking at their settings at random, and then when Yahoo or whoever it is puts it right at their end, then it still won't work because you've changed all your settings. So I would say, you know, use some patience. The other thing that I would say to you is that there are some concerns about security on Yahoo Mail. So if it continues to give you problems, it may be an opportunity to think about using something a bit more secure and a little bit more robust. Yahoo continues to have problems of various sorts. So that's not to say others do not, but you know, Yahoo in particular has gained itself some reputation.
So hang tight, Julian, and hope that it's a problem that Yahoo can fix.
Yeah, let someone else solve it for you. I mean, if after, you know, a week or 2 weeks it doesn't resolve, then start researching to see if it's a known issue. But at this point, I would just hold tight. If the basic functionality of it is still working and it's just a problem with paragraphing, I know that's annoying, but it doesn't stop you sending and receiving email, then I would just hang tight.
Okay, this is a text from Mary. Really interesting one, actually. I was completing an online form and suddenly realised I was answering a lot of personal questions. Concerned that I was on a fraudulent site, I panicked. I closed the site and deleted my history. What should I have done to delete all the details I'd put in?
Okay, Mary. Well, good for you that you thought about it as you were doing it and not just after. it is a problem with fraudulent sites. The key is if you've actually sent the data. So if you've hit a send button or you've paged forward, as you page forward through a multi-page form, data may already have been sent. If it has been sent and they are, you know, fake, then there's nothing you can really do, because they're not going to provide you with the ability to go onto their service and delete it. Even on legitimate websites, you know, when you seemingly delete an account, it's usually not physically deleted. It's flagged as being, you know, inactive, but not, the data still held there and can still be stolen if that legitimate website is hacked. So deleting your history is not a bad thing to do, but it won't particularly solve this problem if you've hit send or progressed through pages, and I'm afraid some of that has gone. As a rule of thumb, be very careful about the information that you provide, and don't always provide consistent information. I'm not suggesting that people should out and out lie, but if there's some wiggle room, I mean, people often, you know, are a bit wiggly about their dates of birth, for example.
I'll tweak a mobile number if I don't want to be rung up. I'm gonna admit it. I put a different number at the end.
Yeah, and another good thing that you can do is you can put in, so for example, sometimes I've got an unusual name, so it doesn't really shock people if there's a few extra characters on the end of the name, and I can actually tell where I've entered that information. If I start getting spam email, you know, with that tweak in it, then I know where it's come from. The other thing that you can do is you can generate individual email addresses for each website that you sign up to. And again, inside the email address, you can put in a bit of the name of the website. And again, if you start getting spammed on that email address, two things: you know that they've been hacked and they haven't told you. And the other thing is you can just disable that particular email address without, you know, having to change all your email addresses, just that one.
Is there any way of knowing if a website's fraudulent? Because if you're putting your payment details in, can't you look for that little locked padlock?
Yeah. So there's a number of things to say. So that's called HTTPS. So at the beginning of a web address, a non-secure website typically starts with HTTP, but if it's got an S on it, that means secure. Depending on your browser, that can appear either as HTTPS or a little locked padlock in one of the corners of the browser, depending on which one you're using. That's a good start, but what that tells you is that the data, when it's being communicated from your computer to theirs, is scrambled. It doesn't tell you anything about whether that website is necessarily legitimate, and moreover, even if it is legitimate, how securely they store your information. So you can have a perfectly legitimate website that uses HTTPS and locks the communication, but still they don't properly scramble the data before they store it. They maybe even store it in a completely unscrambled fashion, and you often hear about that, you know, when someone gets hacked and then there's this big rush to see what's been stolen,
yeah,
and how much of it was encrypted and how much of it was not. So you know, HTTPS is a part of that, but it's not an assurance of very much beyond the fact that it will be hard for people to listen to the data packets as they fly through from your computer to theirs. Not much more than that.
Okay. Now, David in Hitchin, I think, would love to talk to us on the phone. So he's messaged in, but we're going to have to deal with it on a text. Is it possible I can hear people on the end of my phone properly, but they can't hear me? Is there a different signal for the sound that goes out of my phone and the sound that comes in? So David is having phone problems, so he can't phone us.
Yeah. So, if we're talking about a conventional phone, yes. I mean, there's a pair of wires that go from the microphone in your handset, and there's another pair of wires that go to the speaker. And if for example, the microphone has got a bad connection, or there's a poor connection in the wiring in the home or beyond the home, then yes, that can have exactly that effect. You can also find that for different reasons on other types of telephone calls, so things like Skype, what's called voice over IP communication. So they can also have similar problems, although for slightly different reasons. So yes, very much so, it is possible. If you're using something like Skype, by the way, there's a Skype call testing service that you can use where you ring this service, it speaks to you, so you hear it, you then speak to it, and at the end towards the end of the call, it plays back what it heard. So if you can't be heard, then you'll know it at that point, or if you're not heard to good quality.
Is there a way to fix it though, or is it just I've now got this problem that nobody can hear me?
Well, it depends. So for example, if we're talking about a conventional phone line, the easiest thing to do would be to try and plug in a different handset and see if the problem goes away. If it does, then obviously you're talking about the handset. If it doesn't, then you can start speaking to BT or whoever your phone provider is and ask them to do a line check. But you, before you allow a BT or other engineer into your home, you should have checked with their help all the equipment based in your address, because they will charge you an arm and a leg if they come and don't find a fault.
Okay, good advice there. So if, unlike David, your phone is working, it's 08085 909 693 to call us, or 85058 on the text. Let's go through a few more of these texts. Rob in Leeds says, I recently upgraded my EE phone to an LG K8. All the reviews I read stated that it supported Miracast. However, I can't find it, neither could the EE shop where I got it. Any suggestions, please? What is Miracast, for starters?
So Miracast is the ability to cast the content, the video or audio content, from your device onto something like a TV set, a suitably equipped TV set. It may be that it exists in some markets and not others, and by that I mean in some countries where the device is sold and not others. Give me again, and whilst we talk, I'll see if I can find it. Maybe
okay,
a little
so
bit later in the show.
He upgraded his EE phone to an LG K8. And the reviews stated it supported Miracast. However, I can't find it, and neither could the EE shop where I got it.
Mm. Well, yeah, I mean, you think that they should know. Says here, if you have a projector or TV that supports Miracast, you can mirror the LG K8 screen wirelessly. So yeah, looks like it should be possible. Yeah, this is, I'll give you the link, I can't, yeah, connectiontotv.com.
Okay.
And it's in the LG section, how to connect LG K8 to TV, and it talks about Miracast. So,
is it worth Rob maybe sending you a tweet and seeing if that's something you guys can work on?
By all means, yeah, I'm happy to help with that. If you want to send me a tweet, follow me on Twitter, it's @gadgetdetective. And I'll do my best to help Rob or anyone else that needs that help.
Fab, fingers crossed we get that sorted out. Right, Derek in Glasgow's got a couple of questions. We'll do the first one. Can the gadget detective give some advice on how to find a printer where the ink does not cost as much as the best wine?
Oh,
we've talked about printer ink before.
It's so
expensive somewhere.
Yeah. All right. So yes, printer ink can be more expensive per cubic centiliter than Dom Pérignon champagne, and that's actually not an exaggeration. There are different ways of buying printers, and what I mean by that is that there are two types of printers. There are the printers that are sold as loss leaders by companies. They can actually make a loss on the sale of the printer because they lock you into expensive ink cartridges, and therefore your so when you buy any device, really, you have to look at what they call the total cost of ownership. Not just what does it cost to buy, what does it cost to buy and run and eventually dispose of as well. Paper is a known cost, but ink costs very, very widely. And therefore, you can have a situation where you have a £50 printer or even a £10 printer. Some printers sell very cheaply, but the total cost of ownership over, say, 3 years can be a couple of £1,000, depending on how much you print. That's not a bargain. That's, you know, they've got
that's a lot of money.
Yeah, it's wrong. So the best thing is if you're going to print a reasonable amount, and you know, you can do the sums beforehand. You can look up what these cartridges cost from the manufacturer, or you know, or what they call the OEM, original equipment manufacturer, and just work it out. Just estimate how much you print and what that will cost you over time. Bear in mind that ink cartridges also deplete, you know, through things like cleaning the nozzles and all these sorts of things that often go on automatically in the background. So you can buy cheap printers, but often if you pay more for the printer, there's a quid pro quo. Not always, but often, check it, that you can buy printers that are, you know, where you you've bought it for proper money, they've made a profit on the sale of the printer. Yes, all right, they still charge more for the ink than they should, but it's not crippling. So I can give you an example, okay, and this is just from my own personal experience, and you know, other brands have similar ranges. So there is, in the Hewlett-Packard range, there are sort of fairly high-end office jet printers. So these are inkjet printers. The name implies made for offices, but you can easily use them at home. And they can cost, you know, £300 plus. But the ink, it's less than a penny a page, well under a penny a page. And over the life of the printer, even in the first year of the printer, if you print a reasonable amount, that's cheaper than paying silly money for inks. You've then got the question about whether to go for sort of third-party aftermarket inks from, you know, other people, not the manufacturer. The likes of HP try and stop that from happening. And by the way, if your printer manufacturer offers you an upgrade to the firmware, the software built into your printer, look very carefully at what it does, because HP slipped one past their users, which meant it started to reject these third-party cartridges. No benefit to the user, just benefit to HP, okay, and their profit stream. So do the sums, do the research. Often expect to pay a bit more for the printer. Don't be shocked if you have to pay a couple of £100 for a printer or more, because you will often get that back if you've got the cheap inks. Bear in mind also that often you might say, oh, well, I only need to print in black. But often a colour printer with, you know, let's say 5 print cartridges, 4 colour and one black, will not print unless all cartridges are inserted and full, or at least not empty. So you need to be aware of that. And you might think, oh, that's all right, because I'll just, you know, leave the colour carts that it comes with in there. No, you have to budget for those as well, for two reasons. One is those cartridges will eventually dry up if you don't use them. And two, in an effort to stop them drying up, the printer will blow ink through them every so often to keep them unblocked. And by doing that, they will use up the ink. So even if you never printed any colour pages, eventually your colour cartridges will deplete.
Oh, so yeah, definitely worth thinking about when you're paying for it. Derek had another question as well, which was, are HDMI TVs any good as a monitor?
So HDMI is a connector that is now ubiquitous on the back of modern TV sets, and it carries, digitally, it carries both the picture and the sound. And in that sense, it's very attractive because, you know, it's convenient. You haven't got multiple wires coming out of all sorts of things. Is it good for a monitor? It depends on what resolution you want. Even if you have a full HD monitor, that's going to have 1080 lines of resolution on it. You could double that in each direction if you went for an Ultra HD TV, but obviously you pay more for those. But still, that would still have fewer dots on it than a good quality sort of mid-range or upper mid-range monitor. So it really depends what you're using it for. So often you see, for example, TVs used as monitors in recording studios where people want to be able to work on a screen from a distance. So someone with a guitar, maybe not want to sit at a console, can view what's going on at a distance. So they have their uses. And I think, yes, you can do it, but don't expect to be able to get the very highest resolutions that you can get out of things that are designed just to be computer monitors, because a TV will only be able to display at the highest resolution that there's a standard for TV, which is currently Ultra HD, which means that there are 4 times as many dots on the screen as a standard full HD set, which is good for TV, but still weak compared to high-end monitors.
We were talking a bit earlier about Alexa with one of our callers, Graham, and we've had a message in that is from Gordon, who says, should I worry about things like Siri and Alexa listening to what I'm saying, i.e. how much of the day-to-day chat is stored or transmitted to servers, etc.? And you said Alexa being used in this murder trial. We were talking about that.
So it's a very, very good question. The way that Alexa works, and most of these work, is that they have a wake-up word. So they are always listening for the wake-up word. So
it, the is default, it the same for everyone's? Can we wake them all up?
Well, we've been saying Alexa all evening, and that's the default, although you get, there's a couple of other choices with that. But
sorry, everyone.
Yeah, yeah. Well,
morning!
You know, the really bad one was when people started reporting on the news story about how a radio broadcast accidentally ordered dolls' houses on fire. And everyone that reported it then triggered this, and it was a cascading effect. I've forgotten what the question was.
Sorry, they were saying that's my fault. How worried should they be about programmes like that storing what you're chatting about and transmitting it?
On the face of it, not very worried, because although the device will be listening all the time, it is listening for the keyword, in Amazon's case, Alexa, and then it will only transmit everything that follows the keyword until you stop speaking. So on the face of it, you shouldn't worry, because, you know, Alexa is not a common word, except for on this program. and, you know, therefore, your day-to-day speech should not be picked up. Having said that, I have a number of these types of units all over my home. And if I want to say something that is really confidential, believe me, I will unplug it.
Okay.
And it depends how you feel about this. Look, on the Amazon devices, there is a button that you can press that's meant to disable all 7 built-in microphones. And you know it's happened because a red light comes on to tell you that the microphones are switched off. Now, first of all, you have to trust Amazon or whoever it is that is really the case. Secondly, it is possible, these are computer devices, and it's possible to hack them and to have the light on and the microphones on, just in the same way that it's possible to hack the webcam built into your laptop so that the little light next to it that normally comes on when the camera is active stays off, but the camera is active. So and in that case, what you do is you put a bit of tape over the camera, black tape, just to be sure. In this case, if you wanted to say something that you really wanted to keep secure, unplug it. The problem comes as this technology is built into our everyday devices. You're not going to be able to unplug your fridge, but your fridge will be listening. So
it's an ominous thought for 3 o'clock in the morning. Your fridge is listening to you.
Yeah, well, yes. I wouldn't worry too much about day-to-day communication, but the way that these devices work, and this is all to do with what's called big data, they like to collect your speech data, not only to learn more about you, but just to learn more about the way that people speak and all the variety and you know, small differences in the way that we speak, from gender to age to location to upbringing to everything affects it. And when you used to have speech recognition programs a few years ago, when you wanted to start dictating, you'd have to train it for a period. Now it doesn't need training because they use AI to crunch through all that data. So
don't be too worried, Gordon.
You know, I would always be cautious. And yeah. I mean, there's an argument for just saying unplug it when you don't want to use it.
Yeah. We've had a text from Rob, who's in Hereford, which says, I'm partially sighted macular degeneration and I need a new laptop. Yeah. I've been told to go for as high resolution as possible by one person and then by another to go for a low resolution. Any help would be great.
Okay. The best advice, I'm not wanting to pass the buck, but this is a very specialist area. The best advice comes from organisations such as RNIB, who will be up to date on this. I think the important thing is, I mean, higher resolution is always good. There's no harm in that, except if you're running Windows, Windows isn't very good at scaling. So if you've got a lot more dots on the screen, you think, oh, that's good because everything will be crisper, but everything can be a lot smaller. Some like the buttons inside some Windows apps, for example, you know, the on-screen buttons, they shrink in size. If you're using an Apple computer, then that's not a problem because Mac OS operating system scales properly. All these years later, Windows still doesn't do it properly. But the other rule of thumb is to get as big a screen as you can, because obviously, you know, whatever is the issue with scaling and so forth, bigger is always better as far as age-related macular degeneration is concerned. I think more detailed advice from RNIB, but bigger screen as you can, consider a Mac because it scales better Windows experiences patchy. It depends on the app that you're using as to whether you know, certain buttons will become very small if you go for the higher resolution screen. Bear in mind that if you go for too low resolution screen, there's a lot more scrolling around. Like so on a sort of 15-inch screen, I would have something that had at least 900 lines in horizontal lines making up the picture, and preferably 1080.
Okay, hopefully that helps, Rob.